You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Environmental Protection Agency says it plans to loosen rules on methane emissions put in place by the Obama administration. We'll talk to a former EPA official about methane and what the rollback could mean for the climate. Now, we've heard for years that there's a teacher shortage in Wisconsin and around the country. But our next guest says that calling it a shortage doesn't really do it justice. He says it's actually an exodus from the profession. Tim Slecker is dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College. He's the host of Busted Pencils Live on Tuesday nights at 6 p.m. on Talk 92.7 FM Madison and host of the podcast Busted Pencils. Tim, good to have you back on the show.
Hey, thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
So teacher exodus.
Right.
Talk about that. Why?
Well, because if it was a shortage, right, an economic shortage. So when we have a shortage, when there's a shortage of nurses, pay goes up. Conditions get better for nurses, and enrollment in nursing programs goes skyrocketing, okay? So if we have a teacher shortage, pay would go up. It's not. Conditions would get better. They're not. And enrollment in teacher education would go up. It's declining. That can't be a shortage then, okay? So people would say, but we don't have enough special education teachers, Tim. Okay, in that sense, maybe that's a shortage. But you have to, when you call it that, though, it doesn't really then give you the right way to address what might be an answer. Because if it's a shortage, you just think there's some type of incentive program that's going to work. When you talk about the fact that nobody wants to do this job, that parents are telling their kids right in front of me in my office that they don't support their child becoming a teacher, this is a real issue that needs to be talked about quite differently, and that's why exodus is much better, because you have to ask, why are they leaving and why aren't they coming?
Right. You're saying in many ways it isn't so much that there aren't enough good incentives, high pay, good working conditions to bring people in. It's there are negative incentives. There's incentives to drive people out of it.
It's horrendous. We have a 35 years. Nation at Risk was written in 1983. Since then, and I don't want to get too trapped on a long history lesson, but since then, we've gone after education one single way, and that is what we say is accountability, test-based accountability. In other words, we're going to prove either that schools are failing, which they said they were in 1983, and if they don't improve by looking at test scores, we're going to then harm them. Now, over the time, we've looked at this, and what do you have? You now have a mass exodus from public schools of teachers. Some would say, well, that's because they can't handle the pressure. I would say that's the intended outcome, because using accountability, so every student succeeds, no child left behind, you name all these ones and things, they're the what's to blame. People will not let go of accountability, though. They won't let it go because we keep saying, yeah, but how will we get after, and this is a real issue, the achievement gap. The fact that kids in poverty, kids, black and brown kids, aren't doing as well on standardized tests according to different measures, right? So we're concerned about equity in education. You will never achieve equity by spending the few resources that you have, money, on tests. Tests don't produce equity. They just show you that you have inequities.
We have a lot of partisan divides in this country. This is one issue that, in your view, brings both parties together. You think Republicans and Democrats are both to blame here?
Absolutely. I have yet to meet, other than incredibly, really progressive Democrats, but there are people. And the reason why Democrats and Republicans love this, either one is they actually believe that, quote, accountability works. The idea that you're going to just say, Rob, I'm going to hold you accountable for making sure every kid in your classroom gets the best teaching ever. Okay, that's not accountability, because when I then test your kids, even if you're the most awesome teacher, using a test continues to show that kids that don't come to school prepared, don't come from poverty, come from sleeping in a car, all those issues. You don't fix that when you're a great teacher, Rob. You do the best you can to help kids understand and have the best experience they can. When I go to measure you on a test, though, those results, the socioeconomics, the zip codes, the harm, the trauma the kids live through, always show up in test scores. That's why if we continue to use this, we're going to continue to see a flooding away of teachers. So principals and superintendents, it's actually now time for some of these leaders to step up and say, we're causing more harm than we are doing good.
Talking to Tim Slekar, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College. He says teacher shortage, more like a teacher exodus. He says there are a lot of things, mainly accountability and testing at the top of the list, driving people out of the teaching profession. I want to read from one of our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page, a bit lengthy, but a lot for you to tackle here. David writes, as someone who was a young teacher and left, it was a variety of factors, none of which were the actual students, but rather administrative, systematic problems going on. Barely a teacher's union, poor compensation, too many tests, too much required teaching to the tests, forcing students to take classes they don't like or need, disrespectful community members, long hours, among others. Is that something you're hearing from teachers out there?
I hear it all the time. In fact, I'm doing a survey right now. I'm in the middle of writing a book called The Exodus Files, where I've been surveying. I've got over 650 teachers. What you just read is the most common response from almost 90% of my 600 people surveyed. This is what they're talking about. What you've just said, though, is that everything that person just wrote is the result of this hyper-focused, sensitive, hyper-focused accountability, test-based driven. All of those things come from this idea that somehow you're going to measure your way into equity. You can't measure the issues that are at the achievement gap. The achievement gap is the result of inequities, the result of an unjust education system that doesn't look at students differently. Testing, in fact, assumes all kids are the same. And so why would, you know, people get surprised that we get these results, that we keep continuing? It's because kids are different, and they come from different places. They have different experiences. They have different backgrounds. Teachers can't fix a long-term historic racial inequities that are brought that continue to create socioeconomic havoc on the lives of kids.
All right, magic wand.
All right,
testing is gone. We take the resources from that, put it in your control, and do what with it to address these problems?
The first thing is make sure that every kid coming to school has access to every imaginable children's literature. Best children's literature is available. Nothing is a better predictor of being able to learn to read when you get to school as having books in the house, just having books available. So not one more dime under my leadership goes to Pearson. Okay, they've made well over, I think the last thing was like about
this
9.
This is a testing company.
Testing company. This is just one. But, you know, in fact, they're just about to get now $45 million again from Texas. Okay, they've made billions. Okay, we've literally spent across the entire United States, some economists look at it as probably $1 trillion in tests and data systems. I guarantee you that half of that money could have been spent on reducing issues such as books, food for kids, adequate after-school care, and adequate health care. That's it. That's where all the money would go. Then what's ever left over goes back to the classroom for teachers who are professionals who have the ability to make decisions on how to best use that money to get the resources they need for their classrooms, for the individual kids in their classrooms, because as the teachers of those kids, they know what those kids need. And please, not one more dime on, quote, professional development, sponsored actually usually by one of the testing companies that comes in and tries to tell the teachers, you don't know what you're doing. Do it our way and this will fix everything. It really is. It's an insanity. But if you ask why, though, some people say it sounds, do you understand how much money's at stake there? How much money has been diverted from the classroom? Now, if you just heard what I said, and diverted away to data companies, testing companies, you start to understand that there's a political issue here. Why won't politicians let this go? Now you have to start looking and going, what testing company has contributed to politician X? And this is where I say Democrats and Republicans both take a look at where they're getting their money from. They don't like to give that money up.
There is a no-test movement out there. I think we've talked about them on the show
a few
about
years
ago.
Right. I did it in 2011 when my kid actually started the opt-out movement. I think that's helpful, but typically, again, people with privilege are the ones that end up doing that. And so at this point, I'd like to see leadership. The research is absolutely clear. Accountability doesn't work. And, in fact, it won't work. It will not lift poor kids out of poverty when you test them and continue to not give them food, health care, and books. Okay, it's just not going to work. It continues, though, to prove the teachers are failing. And then it continues the onslaught of this kind of the push on teachers to tell them how inadequate they are. And so at a point where I now have teachers say to me, Tim, I now know that I am being asked to do things. And in fact, I've done things that are not best for kids. I'm leaving. I'm demoralized. I cannot do one more thing that will harm a kid in the name of going after some kind of closing the achievement gap. This is where we've gotten to. And so we need leaders to get to the point. And so an education leader like me, particularly getting out there, but more, and political leaders, you need to stand up right now and say, end accountability. Put the money back in the local school districts. Allow teachers to make decisions about what's best for their kid. Because I guarantee you, missing recess, missing gym, missing social studies, and getting 20 extra minutes of reading prep for the reading test is not what's best for kids.
Tim Slekar is with us, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College. He says Wisconsin and the nation aren't just facing a teacher shortage, but a teacher exodus caused in part by federal education policies. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a former or current teacher? What do we get right and wrong in our current system? What do you think about testing? Whether you're a teacher or not, a parent, student, past or present, what do you think of what our guest is saying about our current system of accountability, all the tests that kids take? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Tim Slekar about why he thinks there's more of a teacher exodus than a teacher shortage. He's Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College, host of the podcast Busted Pencils. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've worked as an educator, what do you see as the biggest strengths or weaknesses of our system of education in the U.S., in Wisconsin? Are you feeling demoralized about your job? What do you think about testing? If you're a parent, what do you think about all the tests that kids are taking? What do you think about the idea of holding schools, holding teachers accountable based on how students perform on standardized tests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Kate is with us in Kimberly. Kate, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Kate?
I'm a retired public school teacher. I taught for 26 years, and I believe your guest is spot on with everything. I left earlier than I should have if I wanted to get full retirement. It was just too difficult, you know, too much testing, not enough time with the kids, you know, increased pressure of the scheduling, too much staff development. Like you said, teaching to the test, very difficult. Made it really difficult.
Kate, thanks a lot for the call. So a problem is at both ends, it sounds like, Tim, you're talking about earlier about kids not wanting to go into teaching. And then at the other end of things, a teacher like Kate leaving the profession early.
Right. In my survey, I have 10, 15, and 20-year teachers that I've separated out, and they make up a large portion of people that are either considering leaving or have already left. So these are people saying, I didn't want to, but I have to. And they talk about it from a mental health perspective, which really with some of the things they're sharing, you know, the amount of antidepressants, anti-anxiety medicines, the trauma at home, talking about losing their families because of this. I mean, this is what we're, you know, you can't call that a shortage. You have to look at it from what it really is happening. You've got a mass demoralization, an exodus of professionals who are supposed to be caring for your kids. And at the same time, you're creating a storyline that says, don't ever go into teaching. Who would ever design and imagine that you're going to then create the best education system in the world if you can't even keep people in the profession, let alone try to inspire more people to go into it?
Thanks for that call, Kate. We'll go now to Donna in Brookfield. Donna, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that teachers have to be held accountable. I am a teacher, first of all, let me say that. But we can't throw testing completely out the window because testing also guides our teaching. I have to know whether my students are getting it or not, whether my teaching methods are sufficient for my students or not, so I need to test them. Do I need to test them all the time? No. Firstly, I think the state testing is a bunch of baloney, but I do like things like math testing that we do 3 times a year, and I can compare apples to apples with this kid. Well, what progress is he making over these three testing sessions? And I think another interesting thing is instead of looking at the negative of why teachers are leaving, that's very important, but also look at some of the older teachers who have lived through Act 10 and lived through some of this stuff and say, why did you choose to stay? What is it that made you stay? That might be a chapter in your book.
Donna, mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for the call. A lot there to work with. She likes testing. Well, it doesn't sound like she's talking about accountability.
Yeah, and let's say, first of all, I would have jumped in if this was Crazy Talk Radio and said, no, you don't need to be held accountable. You need to be held responsible. Professionals are responsible. Accountability assumes that there's some form of blame, that when I'm not looking, you're going to then take advantage of an inch and do something. So accountability always comes from a negative stance. Responsibility. You're a responsible professional. Now, when it comes to absolutely needing testing, what she just said, as a professional teacher who wants to decide to use a MAP test, to use a math test that they developed at home during the evening, to design a project based for some type of music, that's assessment. That's not testing. So when people say, Tim, you're against testing, I'm against mandated testing that continues to show all of the irregularities that are present in our society that politicians refuse to take responsibility for. In fact, if you want to throw accountability out, keep it together, we need to hold politicians accountable for the conditions in which our children grow up.
Thanks a lot for that call. Donna, let's go to Jay now in Stevens Point. Jay, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, so I just wanted to comment on the amount of professional development that teachers are required to sit through. Personally, I feel like a lot of it is very redundant, and a lot of it is just, I guess it's the same information spun a little bit different way, and I usually look around the room and I say, hey, there's 30 teachers here all making a wage of whatever, $20 an hour, and we all have a billion things on our plate that we could probably be doing, but instead we have to sit and listen to the information being regurgitated again.
The information that was, of course, your district paid for, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So no, you make the point there too that I, you know, when we talk about professional development, you know, if you asked a group of teachers in a school to put together a professional development sequence to come in there, they would not put together something that was purchased off the shelf with somebody coming in and telling them how inadequate they are and if they just follow the script X. And again, this is why teachers, like we're just hearing from right now, sit in professional development with their, you know, kind of look at each other like going, really? Again? One more person trying to tell us that we need to just listen to them. Crazy stuff, man.
Thanks for the call, Jay. We'll go to Joel now in Madison. Joel, hi.
Hi. So I have a question. You know, we seem to expect teachers to make tremendous sacrifice, but dentists and lawyers make more money. Can we expect our teachers to be excellent if we don't pay them appropriately? And are there other countries where teachers have higher status and better pay?
Yeah, I mean, the quickest point, and everybody gets tired of hearing it, but you just look to Finland. You know, they treat teachers as professionals, and they actually, the waiting list to become a teacher, to get into teacher education. And again, they draw from their, and everybody who wants to rank this, but they draw from their top 10% because of, it's not just pay though. It's the idea of being treated with respect as a professional to make decisions on your own as the professional. Finland has said, we want the best education system. They did this 40 years ago. The first and foremost thing they did was say, teachers need to be professionalized.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. I think Philip with us in Milwaukee. Philip, hi.
Hi. I am retired for quite a while, but I had the honor of substituting for Miss Margaret Joseph when she had her second mastectomy I had her for 3 years at Shorewood High School. She's the only teacher I know of who made the front page of the Milwaukee Journal when she died, because among her past students were Congressman and Secretary of Defense Les Aspin and Supreme Court Justice Rehnquist. Miss Joseph did give standardized tests. It was just one a year, and she gave the test because that was a part of the whole thing. But she knew her students so well because of her excellence in teaching and evaluating. She essentially said, if you do well on this test, it can improve your grade. If you don't do too well, I might take that into consideration.
Philip, I'm going to jump in. We're just about out of time. I guess the case being that this teacher had time to get to know her students and work with them.
And that's incredibly important, the amount of time. Even if you talk about MAPS three times a year, you throw MAPS in with everything else that's mandated, the amount of time lost to real – some people say lost to real instruction. To me, it's time lost building relationships with kids, because teachers are in the business of, yes, teaching and learning, but you can only do that when you can establish a meaningful relationship with your classroom. That only happens with time.
Tim, 30 seconds. Are people listening to what you're selling as an alternative here?
Are they listening? I hope they're listening. And more people talk, as you hear, and they say, you know, they recognize this. The teachers that I've talked to have said, please continue speaking up for us. And this is the sad part, though, is that so many say, I'm afraid to say what you're saying. We need to make sure that teachers who have stories like this have the ability to come forward front and center and make sure that their story is heard. Because without that voice, we're going to lose them. And when we lose professional teachers, we are going to lose the child.
Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Tim Slecker, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College. He podcasts, Busted Pencils is the name of his podcast, with us today about why teachers are leaving the profession. Coming up, methane emissions and the EPA. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, we're getting better at using our seatbelts here in Wisconsin, but there are still serious challenges when it comes to road safety. Kate Archer-Kent talks to a state transportation department official tomorrow morning at 7:30 on the Ideas Network. Now, the Environmental Protection Agency announced last week that it's planning to ease regulations on methane emissions coming from the oil and gas industry. Officials say the current rules put in place during the Obama administration are unnecessary and cost operators millions in compliance fees. But some companies, including ExxonMobil and BP, have said the current methane rules should stay in place. It's the latest move by the Trump administration to ease Obama-era regulations. Earlier this year, it finalized a rollback of carbon dioxide limits for coal-fired power plants. Janet McCabe is a professor of practice in the School of Law at Indiana University, where she directs the Environmental Resilience Institute. She's also the former assistant administrator for the Office of Air and Radiation at the EPA. Janet, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, before we get into the changes, let's talk about methane. A lot of people hear about carbon dioxide and climate change. How important is methane?
Oh, methane is super important. Carbon dioxide and methane are the two most significant greenhouse gases. And molecule for molecule, methane is actually more potent as a climate warming pollutant than carbon dioxide. It's about 25 times more potent. So even if you have less overall emissions, it can be have quite a significant impact.
And where in general does our methane come from that makes its way into the atmosphere?
Well, the biggest source of methane is oil and gas development and use. And in fact, methane is natural gas. So it's the product that people burn in their homes and that can be used to generate electricity. So the whole process of digging it out of the ground and processing it and transmitting it and putting it through pipelines, all of those places along the development process have opportunities for methane to escape, to leak out of pipes and connections and flanges and valves and that sort of thing. So, and that all adds up because there are thousands and thousands and thousands of wells and pipelines and connections all across the country.
What changes now under this proposed rule from the EPA?
So this rule, it's a proposal, which is important for people to know. It's not a final rule yet. This proposal would essentially roll back several important aspects of a rule that was put in place in 2016 by the Obama administration EPA. It would do a couple of really important things. One is that it's proposing to not cover at all certain aspects of the development and processing of oil and natural gas. But perhaps more significantly, although it sounds kind of legalistic, they're proposing to no longer allow themselves to regulate methane directly. And this is really key. Methane is an air pollutant under the Clean Air Act. EPA's job is to issue regulations that will reduce emissions of air pollutants that harm public health. And so that's why the Obama administration did this. This administration is saying, no, we don't think under the Clean Air Act, we have the authority to regulate methane as a greenhouse gas pollutant. So we are proposing to get rid of that from the rule altogether.
And that, in turn, as I understand it, would make it harder maybe for a future administration to reverse this regulation, right? If the EPA says, nope, we don't even have the authority to touch methane.
Well, right. I mean, if they make an argument that stands up in court, which I think is highly doubtful that they would be able to do that, but that's what they're going for here, then it would be difficult, although not impossible, for a future administration to go back again and basically say, no, not what they did, what these other people did before that. And one of the challenges about this is that that's just a terrible way to regulate for public health in this country. And industry does not like it when the regulations whipsaw back and forth like this.
Talking to Janet McCabe from Indiana University, former EPA official, about a proposed rule from the Environmental Protection Agency loosening methane restrictions on the oil and gas industry. One of the arguments, Janet, from the EPA and the White House is that, well, wait, methane is the stuff that a lot of these companies are trying to sell. They already have an incentive to not let it leak out. This is a problem that is fixing itself. What would you say to that argument?
Well, they do say that, and we actually put in place a part one of this rule in 2012 that was captured so much methane that the rule actually made the companies money instead of costing them overall, even if you just look at the cost to the company and the benefits to the company, if you don't even count the public health benefits. So that is true, but, you know, it's like so many activities. People don't always behave 100% the way economists say that they should. And so while there are many companies that are on the forward edge of being very efficient and careful and not wanting to waste this product, we found when we were working on this that there are many that are not so careful. And so that's the point of regulation, is to get everybody on a level playing field. The expectations are the same for everybody. And if you have a regulation, people will be able to build it into their business plan. And that need won't have to compete with other things that cost money for a company but are not required.
So kind of a weird thing here. We're seeing big companies, the ones we've heard of, like ExxonMobil, BP, and Shell, saying, eh, keep these methane rules in place. We're cool with this. But it sounds like some of the smaller and mid-sized companies don't like it as much. They're worried that it raises their costs of maybe new exploration and production. Why do we see this divide?
So there's a couple of reasons why members of the industry would be saying, as they are, to the White House, don't do this. We want these regulations. So one is, if they are already doing these things, then yes, indeed, they want all the industry to have to meet the same compliance obligations and have the same costs. But the other reason is that in some ways, a regulated industry is a safe industry, if I can put it that way. So one of the reasons that people are concerned about emissions, whether it's air or water from oil and gas, is if they think the government is not paying attention and emissions are allowed to just happen as much as the company wants it to. If a regulation is in place and if the agencies, federal and state agencies, are keeping an eye on whether industries are complying, then the public has a sense that the industry is operating in a safer manner. So that, I think, is also a motivation for companies who want these regulations to stay in place.
We're talking to Janet McCabe right now, director of Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute and a former assistant administrator with the EPA's Office of Air and Radiation. We're looking at proposed plans from the EPA to roll back rules on methane emissions from the oil and gas industries. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. What's your reaction to this move by the Trump administration to weaken emission standards, in this case for methane, and past examples from carbon dioxide for the fossil fuel industry? Do you worry about the inability of the industry to do well? Do you worry that current regulations are holding them back, hurting the economy? What questions do you have for our guest about how these things are regulated? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Janet McCabe, professor and director of the Environmental Resilience Institute at Indiana University, formerly with the EPA Office of Air and Radiation. We're talking about the Trump administration's plans to loosen restrictions on methane emissions from the oil and gas industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this proposed plan to loosen regulations on methane emissions, the impact they might have on climate change? Do you have a question for our guest about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Mary is with us in Greendale. Mary, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I am, as usual, shocked by anything that's coming out about all of the, you know, the economy with regard to what we can do to make more money, but also risk of the environment, climate change, whatever. I mean, this is shocking. One thing that I was just talking to a friend of mine who actually is very, very knowledgeable as far as environmental issues. And what he was talking about was the amount of methane that is actually in the core of the earth. So if we have all of these glaciers melting, if we have all of these ice bodies that have been there thousands of years melting, the methane will eventually come out. I mean, I don't know if it's going to come out today, tomorrow, or in 10 years, or in 25 years, or in 1,000 years.
Mary, thanks for the call. Janet, as I understand it, there's a worry about a feedback effect, whereas if the Earth warms up to a certain point, a lot of permafrost and tundra thaws, thus releasing, as Mary was getting at, even more methane. Is that right?
Yeah, and isn't that scary that this is sort of a loop that's building on itself? The warmer things get, the more things melt, and the more methane can escape. The more ice melts, the more black seawater there is, which doesn't reflect the light, which means the warmer it gets. So this is super scary. So this is really behind people saying now and back during the Obama administration, we have opportunities here to cost effectively limit emissions that are happening from these various industrial activities. Let's do that. And we can't, these are the kinds of things that we have to look at in order to try to slow down at least what's happening that's causing all these feedback loops to happen.
Mary, thanks.
A really good point.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Take it in conjunction, these methane proposed weakening of methane regulations plus past efforts when it comes to carbon dioxide and especially coal power plants. Taken together, how big a difference does this make in our overall climate change emissions?
Well, so the Trump administration has gone very effectively after the most compelling and most significant contributors of CO2 and methane emissions in the country. And that makes sense because during the Obama administration, we looked at which are the rules that are going to make the most difference. Where do you get the most, to use a cliche, where do you get the most bang for your buck when you're trying to control CO2 emissions and methane? So the number one emitter of CO2 from industry in the United States is coal-fired power plants. So that was the subject of the Clean Power Plan, and this administration has proposed to roll that back through their rule. The other major source of emissions in the country is mobile sources, cars, trucks, everything that moves on the road. And this administration has proposed to roll back what were known as the clean car standards, which would have required cars to become increasingly more fuel efficient and therefore reduce their CO2 emissions. The third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the country was oil and gas. So so if you take all of those together, you are making a huge impact on the ability of this country to start to reduce CO2 and methane emissions.
Time for another caller. Melissa is with us in Merrill. Melissa, hi.
Hi. I was calling because, you know, methane, isn't that naturally occurring, like through sewer vents, you know, animal herds and, you know, volcanoes, and, you know, prior to humans actually, you know, consuming the land the way that they did, those herds were way larger. So is this really the issue?
Melissa, thanks for the call. She's not wrong about herds. We do have very large herds of livestock, and they are part of the methane math, aren't they, Janet?
They are indeed, and I think she's correct that there are natural sources of methane, but there are also many sources of methane that humans are contributing through animal agriculture, through oil and gas development, and then use. And we're in a situation where every ton of methane or CO2 not put into our atmosphere is a ton that's not going to be contributing to worsening climate situations across the country and in the world. So those things that we can address and can address cost effectively, that's a really important point here. EPA, by the statutes that it is implementing, it's not making things up and telling people it doesn't matter what it costs. EPA is looking at reasonably available and cost-effective technology that many companies are already using and saying, look, we expect everybody in this industry to meet that basic level of control and reduction in emissions when it's so important to public health.
Melissa, thanks for that call. Briefly, as we wrap up, Janet, can you talk about, this is a proposed rule on methane, as you mentioned, what would have to happen before it goes into effect?
Yes, great question, because people should know this is a democracy and people can weigh in. EPA will publish this rule in the Federal Register, and there will be a public comment period that will last 60 days from whatever the date of the publication. EPA will also probably hold a couple of public hearings, and they're more likely to hold public hearings if people ask them for that. We can all ask them for that. People can also send in their comments to the Federal Register. It's pretty easy to do online, and tell EPA what you think, and especially if you have information or data that you think they should have in considering this issue, please do send that to them. When I was at EPA, we welcomed comments and information from all commenters, and we really took it into account when we did our final rules.
Janet, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Janet McCabe is a professor and director of the Environmental Resilience Institute at Indiana University. She's also a former assistant administrator at the EPA's Office of Air and Radiation. She's with us today to talk about plans by the Trump administration, proposed plans that would loosen regulations on methane emissions from the oil and gas industry. Former Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Glenn Moberg passed away this last weekend. Glenn was known as a tough but fair interviewer. He also loved playing music and using sound to tell stories. His skill as a journalist and talk show host could clearly be seen and heard in the hundreds of stories and segments he produced for Wisconsin Public Radio. News director Noah Ovshinsky has this remembrance.
Glenn Moberg had a long resume. He was a talk show host, a musician, active in a community that he loved, a husband, a father, and he was a reporter's reporter.
Glenn, he would come to some events, and he'd have his headphones on, and he'd have his equipment strapped to his belt, and you could see him coming, you know.
Republican State Senator Jerry Petruski has represented the Wausau area for years and was frequently interviewed by Glenn. He says Glenn wasn't afraid to ask the hard questions, but
I think he did his job, and he did it with a real professional, genuine caring about what he was doing and what his job included.
They didn't always see eye to eye, but Petrosky says one of the things that really stuck out about Glenn was his genuine love of central Wisconsin. He says he was truly committed to the people in the region. Glenn asked hard questions. He did not do softballs, both in the field and on his talk show Route 51. As former Democratic state lawmaker Julie Lassa knew well, she represented the Stevens Point region for nearly two decades.
So you had better have done your homework, because he had, and he was going to ask you some really good, thoughtful questions in order to make sure that his listeners were informed on the issue.
Lassa says Glenn would not move on until he got a real answer.
He was always the type of reporter and interviewer to bring you back, to try to make sure that you weren't able to skirt around an issue. I always respected that about him.
With Glenn, though, it wasn't just about the questions. He had high expectations when it came to his work and his guests. According to WPR regional manager Rick Ryer, Glenn's rules were clear.
We would have the opposing candidates in the studio together, and Glenn would sit them down before the microphone went on. He said, "This is how it's going to go. We don't yell in the studio. We have a civil conversation about things we differ on."
Of course, Glenn also had a softer side. Over the years, he covered some of the most tragic events to hit his region. Some made headlines, like shooting sprees and a helicopter crash. Others were smaller stories about pervasive problems like homelessness. In each story, he approached his subjects with empathy and a desire to give a voice to the voiceless. You can hear it in stories like this.
This is the kind of cold that burns your nostrils and hurts your eyes. It's the kind of cold that shuts down schools and even retail businesses. And for the homeless here on the streets of Wausau, it can be deadly.
By the time I walked two blocks, I had ice in my mustache, eyelashes.
Glenn loved sound. He often spoke about the importance of entertaining listeners while also delivering the news. One of his favorite stories, and mine, was about bears. Glenn went into the field with some researchers and took the audience with him.
The party pushes through the spindly growth to the den where the groggy mother lays with her four cubs. Codavis plunges the syringe into her side, and soon she's asleep. The tiny cubs are pulled away and handed one at a time to the volunteers. They look like cuddly teddy bears. They sound like banshees.
Glenn would spend hours working to get the sound just right on stories like that. He also spent his life immersed in other kinds of sound, usually involving a guitar. Glenn was an accomplished singer-songwriter who often played on his show Route 51 and in gigs around the community. Wausau was a frequent muse.
W-A-U-S-A, and the only thing missing is you.
One of Glenn's favorite guests was jazz violinist and composer Randy Sabin. Here they are playing Soul of a Man on Route 51.
Soul of a Man, tell me, Glenn.
What is the soul of a man? For Glenn Moberg, it was a life filled with family, countless friends, music, and bringing the voices of his community alive through his reporting.
That was WPR News Director Noah Ovshinsky remembering reporter Glenn Moberg, who passed away this last weekend. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Congress is coming back into session. We'll look at the prospects for new gun legislation as part of our weekly roundup of news in national politics. As students with disabilities head back to school, an expert gives advice for students, parents, and teachers to help have a successful school year. And instead of running a marathon, how about 3.5 marathons, plus a little extra, too? We'll meet a Wisconsin runner who set, as I understand it, the world record for a 100-mile run. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, some parents are giving up custody of their teenage kids to boost their chances of getting college financial aid. Kate and her guests look at the high costs of college and the extreme steps some families are taking. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about the many benefits of walking in nature, in cities, wherever you can go for a stroll. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.